Thank you. Good evening. How does a notion become a concept, and then a trend, and then a force, and finally a worldwide movement? Well, it helps immeasurably to have an expert proselytizer who understands the concept and has the ability to spread the good news around the world. In other words, it helps to have someone like Karl Honoré. Now, though he may cringe at the title, I think Mr. Honoré is the world's leading evangelist for what has become known as the slow movement. But in spreading the gospel of slow, he is not suggesting for a moment that we all do everything in our lives at a snail's pace, simply that we all stop living our lives on a constant fast forward. His first book, In Praise of Slow, galvanized international interest in changing the way we live. His next book was called Under Pressure, and it critically examined how we parents are micromanaging our children's lives. Now, with his latest book, The Slow Fix, Mr. Honoré shows how changing our neurotic relationship to time can change our lives for the better. Mr. Honoré was born in Scotland, but he grew up in Edmonton, which he claims as his real hometown. He was graduated from the University of Edinburgh with degrees in history and Italian. He has worked with street children in Brazil with Canada World Youth, and he has traveled and reported internationally for leading newspapers and magazines. Currently, he lives in London with his wife and two children. Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Karl Honoré.
Thanks very much.
Thank you for joining us, for coming.
Thank you for that very generous introduction.
I want to start with how you first became aware of and then got involved with the slow movement. It has to do with something about your reading your son a bedtime story. What was that?
That's right. Now we're going back 10, 11 years. I was working as a foreign correspondent, and I had become a roadrunner. Every moment of my day was a race against the clock. And that virus of hurry had infected every corner of my life, including that sacred, slow ritual of reading a bedtime story to my son. So I would go into his room at the end of the evening, and I just could not slow down. So I would be sitting on his bed with one foot on the floor, speed reading Snow White, you know, skipping lines, paragraphs, and whole pages. Then my, you know, my son would say, why are there only three dwarves in the story tonight? You know? And as you say, the moment of truth for me, the moment of personal epiphany came when I found myself speed reading a newspaper article with time-saving tips. And one of these tips talked about this book called The 1 Minute Bedtime Story. In other words, Snow White boiled down into 60 seconds. And I remember thinking, hallelujah, you know. But thankfully, I had a second reaction, and it was the light bulb over the head moment. I thought, whoa, has it really come to this? Am I really in such a hurry that I'm prepared to fob off my son with a soundbite at the end of the day? And that was when I began to look at my own addiction to speed. But as a writer, of course, I wanted to understand the bigger picture, and I began traveling around the world and very quickly discovered that I wasn't alone and that there was another way to think about things like this.
It's encouraging to know that you were as addicted as the rest of us are, but what is the source of the addiction to speed? Why do we live the way we do in terms of hurry up?
I think there's a cocktail of reasons. I think partly it's human hardwiring, you know, that we are programmed to seek out short-term thrills and rewards. I mean, if you think back to the savannah, early man, there was not much incentive to sit back, stroke your chin, and contemplate the Aristotelian long view. You know, it was the here and now, it was the survival of the fastest. I think also there's a kind of metaphysical dimension that speed in a way becomes an instrument of denial. It's a way of running away from deeper questions and bigger problems. And that's why therapists often talk about acceleration as being the final stage before burnout. You know, you have one last surge of speed as you're running away from all those problems. And then of course, the Industrial Revolution, which created machines that allowed us to do more and more things more quickly, and then we've had another great leap forward in the way of speed with the information technology revolution, which has allowed everything to happen now at the speed of software and conditioned us to expect things to happen at the click of a mouse.
Let's just stay with the savanna for a moment. There's some science, as I understand it, and believe me, it's a very rude understanding, that in early times, when man was confronted by a lion or something, there wasn't a lot of time to discuss options. You just had to get the hell out of there. Is that exactly where it comes from?
Essentially, it's this idea, and anytime you stray into the world of neuroscience, you've got to stray carefully and tread lightly because we know so little, really, in the greater scheme of things. But I think we're getting to the point where we do know that there are, roughly speaking, two forms of thinking, and people talk about system one and system two. And system one is that instant, instinctive, intuitive, shoot from the hip kind of reaction. You see the saber-toothed tiger gazing at you across the pond, your brain instantly maps an escape course through the jungle. You go, you're down it.
Yeah.
Quick fix, done and dusted. System two is the more considered thought. You know, when someone asks you, what is 32 times 14? Or when you're asked to contemplate what a social policy would mean for downtown Montreal. That's a different kind of mode of thought. So clearly in the old days, I think that the system one was probably much more called upon and much more useful than it is today. The trouble is, of course, we have the same brains. And we live in a world now where we need much more system two thinking. We need much more slow thinking, but we are almost hardwired, I think, to reach first for the easy fix, the quick fix, the system one approach.
I want to get at the system two in a moment, but the quick fix, it's everywhere. It seems to infect, if that's the word, certainly influence or inform almost every area of our life.
It does.
Is there, in the book, I read that there is a quick yoga. Is that right?
Yeah. Yes. I mean, even the things that are by their very nature slow and designed to slow us down, we're trying to speed them up too. So there is, in fact, near my house in London, a gym that runs a speed yoga course. Speed yoga for time-starved professionals who want to salute the sun and bend their bodies into the lotus position, but they want to do it in 20 minutes instead of a whole hour. So, you know, and in fact, even these deepest rituals that are all about slowing down, they have been infected by this virus of hurry as well. I was in Austrian Vienna a little while ago, and I met the Monsignor who was in charge of one of the cathedrals in Vienna, 1,000-year-old cathedral, everything very, very serene, Gregorian chants. And he came up to me after an event and said, I'd been talking about slowing down, and he said to me, you know, I have a confession to make. And any time a Catholic priest comes up to you and says, you're on your guard, right? But thankfully, we didn't go down that road. He said, I listened to you speaking, and I suddenly realized that how easy it is to get infected by this virus of hurry. I've been praying too fast, right? So it as you say, it shows that even in those activities, those tasks that are all about being still, being contemplative, pondering, ruminating, we still want to go for that quick fix option.
Well, you talk in the book, in the slow fix, you talk about Bill Gates, Microsoft, and his laudable efforts in global health, and how he set up a program to get it done fast.
And it's interesting that Bill Gates comes from that engine of speed, that is the Silicon Valley and all of that, and they come with this idea that somehow if you spend a lot of money and write really good algorithms, you can solve every problem very, very fast. And Bill Gates discovered, to his dismay, that that's not the case. He put out, I've forgotten the exact figure, it was something like $400 million. It was a huge amount of money was offered, tendered, thousands of projects came in, they picked a bunch, and they were going to revolutionize world health in 5 years. And then 5 years later, they hadn't revolutionized world health.
And he admitted that.
His words were, we were naive.
Tell me about the rise and fall of Toyota, and specifically, I never heard this before, pulling the Andon rope.
Mm. It's a wonderful image and metaphor. And in fact, I wanted to use it as a title of my book, but my publishers persuaded me that it was too obscure. So I went with a slow fix in the end. But the story of Toyota is that, in fact, if you go back, Toyota was a supreme practitioner of the slow fix because they had this rope, they still do, from their factories hanging in every factory called the Andon rope or the Andon cord. And if anything went wrong on an assembly line, even the lowliest worker could pull the Andon rope and a light would go on, and his team leader would come and they'd look at the problem and they would ask themselves why, until they got to the heart of the matter, what was really wrong, and then they would fix it. And if they couldn't fix it on the spot, they would actually stop the whole assembly line until they got it fixed. And that, to me, is the slow fix in action. But what happened when Toyota decided that it wanted to become the number one car maker in the world is that, effectively, it stopped pulling the Andon rope. They began having problems and ignoring them. They were getting emails and memos sent up from staff on the ground, on the trenches, warning of things going wrong that were just ignored, that weren't dealt with. And we all know where that ended up, don't we?
Largest recall in history.
10 million cars recalled, shredded reputation, and what was it, $2 billion in lawsuits pending?
Why is it important? You make the point that in trying to redevelop the quick fix or upholster your life in such a way that you don't do that anymore, you said it's important to admit mistakes. And you use as an example an RAF pilot.
I think that admitting mistakes is often the first step to building a slow fix. Because when a problem presents itself, usually one of the reasons is that someone has made a mistake or something has gone wrong. And until we take the time to confront that mistake and deal with the emotional fallout that goes with the shame and the embarrassment that provokes, and then also take the time to learn from the mistake, then we can't really move on to developing a slow fix. So this RAF example, the Royal Air Force in Britain, they discovered that a lot of the mistakes that people were making were just being covered up. They weren't being shared, and because of that, people were dying. Planes were crashing, problems weren't being uncovered. So they devised a whole system to encourage everybody in the RAF, from the most humble mechanic to the most glamorous, lantern-jawed, Top Gun pilot, to own up to every single mistake, and found very quickly that they were starting to solve problems. In fact, before the problems even arose, because they would, a small near miss that would have just been brushed aside or ignored in the past was then brought to the attention of the authorities, who investigated it, and often would avoid a small problem becoming a bigger one later, which in a way underlines the delicious paradox of the slow fix, which is that sometimes it's not that slow. You know, sometimes the results are not only better than a quick fix, but you get them more quickly.
I've always been puzzled in anything to do with airplanes why it's called a near miss, because it's really a near hit, isn't it? I mean, in your exploration of the subject, is there a culture or a society where slowing down has actually worked at various levels, either in government or private? Private industry or education or culturally?
People always ask me that question, and I don't think that there is one country that stands out as the top of the league table for it. What I do think is that each country has some good slow in it and some bad slow and good fast and bad fast. And some countries do some things slow very well. So you mentioned education. Finland is famous for having an enormously successful education. And it has a lot of slow ethos to it. You know, children don't start schooling until the year in which they turn 7. They spend fewer hours in the classroom. They do less homework. There's no tutoring industry. They don't sit hardly any exams apart from, later in their careers. And then when they do sit down to do the international PISA exams at the age of 15, competing against 500,000 kids from around the world, they routinely come out top or very near top,
one or two,
top of the chart. Yeah. Charts. So that's one example in Finland. People think of the Italians as being, you know, wonderfully slow with food. And of course, slow food grew from the Italian culture of, mangiare bene and sitting around the table and all that stuff that we hanker after in the Anglo-Saxon world, where it's all about ready meals and microwaves. But then on the other side, the Italians, if you've ever driven on an Italian highway, you know that the Italians are in touch with their inner hare as well as their inner tortoise, right?
Is there a connection, a viable working connection between the slow fix and creativity?
Hugely. I think that there's an intimate bond between slowness and creativity.
How so?
I think that this is something that you find throughout history and throughout disciplines as well, that artists will talk about that moment in the creative journey when you forget the clock. People talk about being in a state of flow when they forget the clock, they forget time, it's a timeless moment. And also those moments of fogginess, blurriness, uncertainty, when you can just about just about discern the silhouette of what's coming, and you feel a bit uncomfortable, but you sit with it and you come out the other end. And that's something that you hear from scientists, it's something you hear from engineers, designers, that there's always a moment of slowing down somewhere in the creative process. And that's why the most creative companies and organizations in the world are trying to claw back little moments and spaces for people to slow down, whether it's, I mean, a classic example is Google with its famous 20% rule.
What is that?
There's been a slight modification of it recently, but essentially what they did was they allowed their engineers and creative people to devote 20% of their working time to personal projects. So, you know, no timetables, no targets, just that kind of free-flowing, almost a kind of daydreamy thing. And it sounds on the face of it like a waste of time or a slacker's charter. But in fact, of course, what happened is that, you know, many of Google's home run products like Gmail and One G News or Google News came out of that 20% time because people were able to slip into that richer, more nuanced form of thinking. I mean, there's been some research also that suggests that the brain waves, when we're in a relaxed state, move into a more complex pattern and get these creative breakthroughs. Psychologists refer to that as slow thinking. And in fact, I think we all know that, don't we, from our personal lives, whatever work we do. We know that our best ideas seldom come when we're juggling 9 emails or racing to meet a 5 o'clock deadline with the boss hanging over our shoulder. They come when we're soaking in the bath, right? Or walking in the park with the phone switched off, or swinging in a hammock.
I forget who said it, but it was something like, the problems of the world are caused by the inability of people to sit quietly in a room alone for an hour. Under pressure, I want to talk just a bit about that. That was a look at how we, and I include myself, are parenting our children these days. And you use the phrase, the free-range child. What did you mean by that?
Well, I grew up in Canada, and my childhood was kind of the 70s and the 80s. And I think anyone in the room who grew up probably before about the mid-90s will have the same memory of childhood being what Virginia Woolf called a great cathedral of space, you know, that kind of feeling of amplitude, of not being scheduled to within an inch of your life, of spending all of your time outdoors. You know, that thing you'd say to your mom, I'm bored, and she'd just kick you outside, and you'd go out and run wild with the local kids, and then you'd hear, lunch, and you'd come back, and you'd go out again, it would be dinner, and that sort of thing. And it's that has been completely jettisoned now, as children live like mini adults with their own personal planners, and we've professionalized child rearing, so that playing, free play, just children messing around, and we know from the research that that is when, you know, we've seen it in our own lives. You know, a child is walking down the street with your 4-year-old daughter, and she spots a ladybug on a rose bush, and she can stop there for 20 minutes, and she'll give that ladybug a name, she'll weave a whole narrative around it, she'll watch it scuttling up and down the rose bush, and we know from, you know, brain research and everything about science tells us that in that moment, her brain is on fire. You know, she is building her brain extraordinary fireworks. And yet we see that nowadays and we think, that kind of looks like a waste of time. So we separate her from the ladybug, grab her by the wrist and say, come on, we're late for ballet. And off we go. And I think it's those ladybug moments that have been squeezed out of the childhood experience now. And that's in a way what I think of as a free-range childhood is the freedom to, the time, space, and freedom to explore the world on your own terms rather than have it spoon-fed to you and micromanaged.
You also talk about slow cities. Mm. We don't live in a city in Toronto. We live in a parking lot. And it's almost impossible now to get from A to B, but we're rushing at it. Mm. What is a slow city?
Well, a slow city with a capital S and a capital C, there is actually an official movement which started again in Italy but has spread across Europe and beyond.
Thank God for the Italians,
yeah,
eh?
They've got some things right.
Right.
And the slow city, I mean, that particular movement is aimed at cities of up to 50,000 inhabitants, and there's a long list of changes they need to make. But it boils down to redesigning and rethinking the urban landscape in ways that encourage people to slow down, to smell the proverbial roses, to put on the brakes. So closing roads to traffic, you know, more green spaces, that sort of thing. But in some ways, I think being a slow city is greater than the sum of those parts. It's a bit like a philosophical declaration. It's like a whole town coming together and saying, we understand that slow is good, that slowness has a role to play in the 21st century. And that is very liberating, because people, even, you know, there's the taboo against slowing down is so embedded and so ingrained in our culture that even when we can feel in our bones that it would be good for us to put on the brakes, our bodies are telling us, our minds, our souls are crying out for a little bit of slowing down.
Then what's the problem?
We're ashamed to do it. We're afraid to.
Why, though? Is it embarrassing, or are we afraid of not keeping up with the Joneses or something?
I mean, yeah, it is that. I think it's, I mean, it's woven into our vernacular, isn't it? You know, you snooze, you lose. The early bird catches the worm. All these phrases are there bombarding us with this idea that if you slow down, you're lazy, you're boring, you're roadkill, right? And that slow is almost a dirty word. It's a pejorative. It's a four-letter word in our culture, so that people are afraid to. I mean, I think that the slow movement has done a lot to recapture that word.
There was an American writer named Nicholas Carr, and a few years ago he wrote a piece in The Atlantic entitled, Is Google Making Us Stupid? And he said that he found, since using Google and various devices, he had lost what he calls deep reading ability. He could sit down prior to this and read for 3 or 4 hours. Now, he said, after 40 minutes, his attention wanders. Do you find, are you a slow reader, or how do you?
I recognize that phenomenon, and I think you've got to be very disciplined about the use of these gadgets. And they are wonderful, joyously addictive, and I have them all, but they all come with that little red button that says off. And I went through a long time of never using that, but now I use it a lot. And I think it's that changing of gears. It's saying, okay, there are times when I'm on my iPhone, there are times when I'm tweeting, and I'm on Facebook, and I'm doing my social network dance and all that. But I'm not going to be on that all the time. And I think the brain needs those moments of, you know, shifting out of high speed to low speed and all that those different tempos and paces. And I think that allows you to retain the ability to read deeply.
But you're a writer. You were a foreign correspondent. You had to face, as we all do, deadlines. And the tradition in journalism, the deadlines are inviolable. You do not miss a deadline. Isn't that a form of being controlled or managed by, if not speed, certainly pressure, to deliver a certain thing at a certain time?
Absolutely. And I think deadlines are they're a kind of double-edged sword, because in some ways they're very useful. They focus the mind. And if you have a procrastination gene, they're useful for getting you to deliver the goods on time. And that's important. The trouble, I think, is that we fall into deadline mode. So we're in the office, and we've got to deliver that quarterly report or the article or whatever it is by 6 p.m. We get through it, we deliver, we go home, and we're still on deadline mode. We're eating our dinner as though the boss is waiting for us to finish, you know. And I think it's about being aware that we get stuck in those modes and finding little levers, little things to do, to whether it's as simple as just breathing deeply 4 or 5 times, you know, and reoxygenating the body, lowering the blood pressure, something as small as that, which no boss is going to begrudge you 5 deep breaths. I mean, he might even join you.
You don't know the CBC, man.
That's true. Yeah. Although, actually, no, I think about it. I'm not sure if you want to be sharing heavy breathing with your boss. I mean, that could end in trouble, couldn't it?
There was a story a couple of years ago about a department of government in Ottawa where the deputy minister told his staff that from Friday night until Monday morning, they were not to use their BlackBerries. They were not to communicate in any way with that. The idea being that people could unwind or decompress. And some people complained about it and said, that's unfair. We want to use our. So how do you change the way we think in order to change the way we act?
I think you have to, that sort of, an example like that, you have to do it in baby steps. And you have to go with the people who want to go with it and gradually bring along the people who don't. And I think once the people who, often you'll find that the people who don't are resisting through fear. And once they see that it works for the other people, it works for the team, that everybody is happier, healthier, enjoying their family time more, and coming back to the office sharper with better ideas because you've had that time away from the coalface, I think you start to bring people around. And you mentioned that one example. There was an intriguing one in Britain where when David Cameron took over as prime minister, 3 years ago, I guess, his first act, well, decree as prime minister was to ban the use of smartphones in all cabinet meetings.
Really?
Just to get people to focus, right? You know, to pay attention. And
were
they found
people on the phone in cabinet meetings?
Even in cabinet meetings, when they're just, I mean, which may explain some of the really bad decisions we get for our governments, you know. And I spoke to somebody who's in that world, and they said it did make, you know, people did chafe against it at first. They thought, why do I have to stop looking at my inbox? But over time, they came around, and it worked.
How do you embed the idea of slowing in your daily life? How do you have a schedule, or do you get up and, you know, do you compartmentalize?
Yes, I suppose I do have a schedule in the sense that I've got children who impose a schedule. So there's a child, you know, one to get up at 7, and another one goes to school a bit later. And then I come home, and we have just family dinner every evening of the week, unless I'm traveling. I come home for time for dinner. So that bookends my day. But otherwise, I try not to overschedule. I try to leave. Because this is one of the things when people say, what do I do to start slowing down, to let some oxygen into my diary, to get off this crazy treadmill? One of the things I suggest, it sounds a little bit paradoxical, is to schedule unscheduled time. You know, I sort of feel like we've almost reached that point where we have to ring fence off a couple of hours where we don't put anything in the diary, right, the planner. Because nowadays we have such a neurotic relationship with time that we see a hole in our schedule, and instead of rejoicing and thinking, there's some downtime to look forward to, we panic and rush to fill it with something that's really often not that important.
I get a great thrill, a great frisson, when someone calls up and says, I'm sorry, I can't make it for lunch.
I know.
I can't, you know.
Yeah, that's so true.
And my God, you can't? That's terrible. And I love that. I think that's... Can you give us, let me ask you finally, if you could be doctor honorary for a moment, give us a prescription. Are there some basic steps or fundamental things that we could do without killing ourselves?
Yeah, absolutely. I would say the first is, coming back to what I said before, just breathe. You know, if you feel that kind of very panicky, everything's moving way too fast and spinning out of control, just stop for a moment and breathe deeply 5 times, and it will make a physical difference, which can start to percolate up into how you feel in your head. A second suggestion, I guess what you're asking for is quick tips to slow down, is that right?
So I'll rattle through these.
Yeah, speed it up, will you?
We've got a deadline.
Come on, let's go.
The clock is ticking.
Come on, spit it out.
The second quick tip would be what I call a speed audit, which is just, you know, every once in a while through the day as you're doing an activity, stop and ask yourself if you're doing that activity at the right speed. And if you're going too fast, slow down. Very simple. It's so often we find ourselves doing something more quickly than we need to just by default without even thinking about it. And it can be enough just to stop and say, am I driving too fast? Am I eating too fast? Am I reading this bedtime story too fast? And if the answer is yes, and very often it is, just go back a little more slowly. And another thing following on from that, I think, is that idea of scheduling unscheduled time. Set aside, say, I'm going to take 2 hours on Sunday morning when I don't let anything get into that time. And I arrive at whatever it is, 11 on Sunday morning, and suddenly I have that, you know, that cathedral space of slowness. And I can go with the flow, I can rest, I can enjoy a serendipity, because we're so highly programmed and scheduled now. We don't, you know, people ring up, we can't follow it because we've got to get on to the next thing. And then lastly, of course, technology. You know, take 30 minutes, say tomorrow, pick 30 minutes when you just switch everything off. It might be when you get up in the morning, instead of manically reaching for your inbox, which probably is by your bed, just take 30 minutes, go have breakfast, and then after 30 minutes, look. Or maybe it's 30 minutes at lunch, or maybe it's 30 minutes when you come home from work, and the first 30 minutes in the home, you talk to your partner, everything's switched off, you talk to your partner, you talk to your kids, and those things actually can make quite a big difference in starting to...
That Sunday morning thing wouldn't work for me.
That's true.
For various reasons. That's true. Yeah. The other night, I was trying to get my teenage son to hurry up with something, and he turned to me and he said, come on, Pop, YOLO, YOLO. And I said, what the hell is YOLO? YOLO, you only live once. There's insight.
From the mouths of babes.
It's a Carl Honoré.
Thank you.
Thank you. Wonderful. That was terrific.